Hello, everybody.
Greetings.
Hello, everybody. Jeffrey,
Hi.
did you get in a fight over Sri Aurobindo?
No, I fell over in the street.
Oh, my goodness. Are you okay?
I'm okay.
Good, good.
Those who've seen me earlier in the week will see that things are getting slightly better, but
You were completely swollen shut.
yeah.
I'm glad you're okay.
Yeah.
You're looking better.
Yeah, it is better.
Were there any lingering or kind of after effects?
I've had a few small headaches at the back. They're sort of, they did say if you had persistent headaches to go back and see them, but not really big enough to worry about. But it's not been easy to work this week or do reading.
Yeah.
Although I did get, I am caught up for today, so that's something.
Well, we have a couple minutes. Let's if we're going to give it a couple of minutes for other folks to join us. You were just walking across the street. Was there something that happened that?
No, I think it was my sandals. I think I tripped and with my sandals, and I was just stepping off the sidewalk onto the street, and it was quite a big step. So I think I just tripped at that moment and couldn't recover my balance. One of those stupid little things that sometimes happens in life.
Moment of inattention. It's like, I wonder if the universe happened that way. Supermind wasn't paying attention and suddenly.
Tripped and fell.
Yeah.
It's a big trip.
Yeah, so while we have a couple of minutes, just to give another couple of minutes, the chapters that we had scheduled for today, I'll say this for the benefit of anybody watching this, were chapters 10, Knowledge by Identity and Separative Knowledge, 11, The Boundaries of the Ignorance, and 12, The Origin of the Ignorance. So that's least what we read. We'll see what we discuss. I don't think there's quite nobody volunteered at least to lead the discussion or structure this in a particular way. But if there is interest among anyone here to go in a particular direction after we meditate or before, just let me know. Otherwise, we could just sit in our ignorance.
And Jeffrey, you noted that you completed this particular reading. Have you caught up from the entire
No,
reading? Okay.
I've got to catch up on the rest of it.
About to say that was quite a leap of reading there. So.
I powered through it early this morning and had some.
I have to say, I love the quotes at the beginning of each chapter. I find them in some ways even more pithy from than the chapters, you know. They're all very interesting, the quotes.
You'd probably really like the reading the Upanishads and the Veda.
It's on my list of things to read, definitely. Yeah. Maybe we could start the meditation with that one, this one reading from the first, from chapter 10, which is, so I'll read it if you'd like.
So you'll read it and then Would you like me to hit the bell?
Yeah, yeah, and then we'll do the meditation after the, so.
Okay, perfect.
Could I suggest we meditate for a minute and then you read it?
Sure.
Yeah, thank you. You're talking about the first Brihadaranyaka quote.
Yeah. No, where there is a duality is the one that I really liked, yeah.
Brihadaranyaka.
Yeah.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, maybe I'll chat a little bit later. A lot of this is infused with the Mundakya Upanishad. I'll maybe chat about that when we're in session.
Well, shall we begin? I'll hit the bell, and Jeffrey, you could intuit a minute and then start, and then we can sit for another 3 or 4 minutes, and then.
Yeah, that would be good.
Okay.
Where there is duality, there other sees other. Other hears, touches, thinks of, knows other. But when one sees all as the self, by what shall one know it? It is by the self that one knows all that is. All betrays him who sees all elsewhere than in the self. For all this that is the Brahman, all beings, and all this that is, are this self.
Well, perhaps we could begin with identifying in this first chapter that we read for this week, chapter 10, the four kinds of knowing or knowledge that Aurobindo identifies. And from there, feel out where we want to go in terms of the exploration. But the chapter is called Knowledge by Identity and Separative Knowledge, so by identity and separative. And there are four kinds of knowledge that he names and then explores in this chapter and in the subsequent ones. The first he calls a knowledge by identity. The second, a knowledge by intimate direct contact. The third, a knowledge by separative direct contact. And the fourth, a wholly separative knowledge by indirect contact. So it's kind of a grid there of identity, non-identity, contact, direct or indirect contact. And it seems to me the overarching theme of these chapters is to articulate the ways that we know that are not precisely the ignorant ways, which conventionally would be what we meaning modern Western society actually considers knowledge in the sense of sense knowledge or scientific knowledge belonging to the physical realm, the waking state of consciousness. And I read Aurobindo here describing other ways of knowing that have to do with different modes of perception, different kinds of experience, and a contact or an identity with different realms of being. So some of that is what we would call psychic or paranormal type phenomenon. Some of it may come in dreams or in subliminal kinds of perception. And then there's another kind that is, although he doesn't use this word, I might say mystical. So I'd like to ask how you, the other participants here, understood these distinctions that he's making here at the outset, and how those speak to or resonate with your own sense of what you know, or how you know, or how we know.
Well, I think there's a lot here that I resonate with for sure. Just seems like on every page, he plays with so many different metaphors. The veil, the sea, the wall. I think he's talking about the sheaths. But he repeats over and over again, the subtle physical, subtle / physical, which reminds me of that, I can't pronounce his name. He's a mystic, a tantric master in the 13th century.
Abhivanagupta?
Yeah, exactly, thank you. I've read quite a bit about him, but he talks about the hybrid body, which is in between the physical, the subtle, and the, what he would call the causal. And this hybrid, it's not entirely subtle or physical, it's in the in-between. And he believes that, and I believe Aurobindo does as well, that there are certain conditions when there's an interplay that can happen. And that what we call now paranormal is actually, would become totally natural, except for our human stain, the belief that we have that we are just not good enough. And this human stain seems to be almost universal. But it's a belief that we have that we cannot lift the veil. But I think the message here over and over again is that we can. Yes, we can, and we must, actually, if we're going to survive. I thought there was a turning point in the conversation. One of the things I really like, maybe I can quote it, but he's talking about this double nature. So I think this is what he's talking about, this double nature. We're a part of and apart from, and we're constantly in the in-between. And it's full of paradoxes and impasses and conflicts and oscillations in between. And so, all of us get stuck, and we also have places that are really rough for us. And then there are unprecedented opportunities that open up for us. I think he's talking about the subtle realm here. He talks about the wall. The ego is a wall. And he goes on for a couple of pages on that. But he says, ultimately, the wall can turn into a fence. And I think that's when the ego has, when the ego becomes permeable to these impressions from the subliminal. So I think he's basically trying to, these phase spaces between the subliminal, you guys will have to help me out here, the subliminal, the superconscient, the supramental, but it seems to be there are these boundaries are can become quite permeable and transparent, and can be played with. And I think he has some very sophisticated ideas here that sound very much like out of cognitive psychology. He really does, I think, reject the Freudian idea of the unconscious as something that's hostile to us, and that the ego has to sit on top of. And on top of the ego is the superego. So this hydraulics metaphor, which Freud drew upon and popularized, I think Aurobindo rejects. I think the inconscient is not the same thing as Freud's unconscious. I also think he's very different from Jung, although I think he's closer to Jung than he is to Freud. I think Jung was sort of like a neo-Kantian in a way. We cannot know the thing itself. Jung didn't say that, but I think he still lived within the confines of that very positivist science. And he had, of course, his red books, which were incredibly powerful expressions, but they were all, they weren't published until after his death. So I think he was very much a product of his time. So I think Aurobindo is doing something else. And I think this is, I think, awe-inspiring. I think it's just wonderful read for me. I didn't get to read the last chapter assigned, but the first two I read, I thought it just flowed beautifully. So I feel like, I think the metaphysician here has become a magician. And I think that's where, Aurobindo is at his best. I thought the first book was really tough, but this one seems to be, I feel like a turning point has been reached. And he talks about I think the turning point is another metaphor he uses. Anyway, those are some of my impressions. And I have a lot more to say, but I'm very curious about how other people are responding to this. So thank you.
I'll briefly add to what you said, John. Because I took to the wall and the fence metaphor, because it resonates with a couple other things we've been exploring. And when he mentions the fence, that's when he's starting to describe the subliminal as that mode or that state in which, yeah, it becomes permeable. We can see beyond the wall. We can see through towards what else is out there. So yeah, I really like that portion.
You know, last year I read the Future of Religion, The Religion of Tomorrow by Ken Wilber. I read the whole book. I read every footnote. I read it the week it came out in English. And in that book, you know, that's how I come to this Aldo Binder reading. In that book, he talks about all the pathologies that go on the third tier level. And so knowledge by identity, that's basically this very direct perception. And for me, I think there are all kinds of, shadow elements or like just things in your own psyche that hold you back from seeing directly, from experiencing like this knowledge, Wissen durch Identität, knowledge by identity. And, the reason why people, can't perceive clearly, can't, you know, experience this is because throughout their life, they somehow get stuck, you know, they have some shadow issues and they pop up all the time and they can, it can be experienced at this at the higher levels as well, and something like this kind of I think happens for me here. So I think this wall that he talks about, you could see this maybe as a kind of shadow, as a kind of some traumatic stuff that just happens and it doesn't let you see a more direct, immediate perception of the world.
Does anyone have the paragraph marked with the wall and the fence analogy? Yeah. I thought I marked it. I don't see it.
Yeah, I do have it. In my version, it's page 541, the second paragraph.
We have a different version.
For you, Mateo, it's paragraph 19.
Thank you.
He's
nerd.
Yeah, I'll just quote him briefly. The subliminal is separated from the cosmic through a limitation by the subtler sheath of our being, its mental, vital, subtle physical sheaths, just as the surface nature is separated from universal nature by gross physical sheath, the body. But the circumscribing wall around it is more transparent, is indeed less a wall than a fence. The subliminal has become a formation of consciousness which projects itself beyond all these sheaths and forms a circumconscient, an environing part of itself, through which it receives the contacts of the world and can become aware of them and deal with them before they enter. So it seems like I imagine that as the as we become more versatile, those shadows stop scaring us, and we can develop enough skill that we But the wall, the ego wall, which is, you know, in its earlier formation, perhaps a little paranoid and definitely has a conservative tendency as it locks down, neuromuscular locks. But as the vitality and the energy starts flowing through the system, the wall becoming the fence, there's still a boundary, but it isn't a rigid one. I think that's the shift that I believe Aurobindo is trying to capture in this wall to fence transition. So that's very hopeful. So the ego turns into, rather than a wall that blocks and keeps inside and outside separate, becomes a fence. And I think you can have good neighbors. Isn't there a poem by Frost about neighbors and fences? So I believe there's a versatility there that he's pointing to. I believe many of us have observed in our own, when we are at our best and we're not operating out of that conservative, hunkered down kind of mentality of the ego wall. I don't believe, need to annihilate our egos. I think that would be extremely self-destructive, because I think he sees a value in the ego.
It's impossible.
yeah. It'd be disastrous if unfortunately there are some people who don't have very well functioning egos, and it's not pretty. So I think that's a very encouraging. A turning point also, he uses that, I think this is the turning point in a previous paragraph before he makes this wall to fence transition. He talks about a turning point. So I think he's sort of foreshadowing that development.
So that's at the end of paragraph 17, just to note the turning point.
So yes. I was sort of noticing how observant he is. I mean, I guess he wrote the whole book while he was in prison, so maybe he had a lot of time to be observant. No, maybe not the whole thing, but anyway, he had some time to think about these things or to observe it, because it's very clear for an observant looking at what's going on inside. It's very clear. I mean, even in the parts which are mainstream, if you like, but of course it's mainstream today, but it wasn't mainstream when he wrote about it. So, you know, in terms of what's going on cognitively and so forth, it was very new at the time. So I just sort of struck by it. The other thing I wanted to say about it, so I'm going to read the poem that I wrote after I fell down in the street that I put up on the site, because I had a bit of an epiphany. I don't know when it happened, but the poem talks a little bit about it. So the poem is called Sunday Afternoon. Crossing the street, a moment of dizziness. Sky and ground fuse, asphalt falls upon my head, stings like sizzles of rain on hot pavement. And yet, underneath the pain, a brook bubbles, a welling from inside that refuses to be balked. There's nothing like pain to wake you up to the amazing burst of power in each instant of time incarnated within body. Hospital sounds, conversations, serious talk, voices raised, insults and placating, gratitude and pleasantries. Murmurs, phones ringing, insistent whirs, buzzes, creaks and moans, alarms, bells, grunts and sighs, whispers, rustling, people moving quietly. My inner kinesthetic space is distorted, skewed upward and to the right, while vision there is reduced. A swollen eye stares back from the mirror when I slip away to the washroom. When I got up, I had to pay attention. Can't afford another bout of dizziness. Eye half shut and singing, a throbbing somewhere above and behind, still and unsure, clicking of a keyboard, and a binder opening and being shut, concentration gone to pieces, all is in flux. Young man, curly brown hair, stares and thinks, types, stands up and looks around at his patients, offers a glass of water, checks where the doctor is, returns and works silently. The doctor arrives, a woman, just as I had imagined. She's all business and I am soon liberated. Free to go home, no concussion, phew. Just a lesson. Vulnerability is always just down the street. But the point is about the bubbling underneath the pain. So I don't know when this happened, but sometime in the last few weeks, I developed this, I don't know how to describe it, but this broad feeling of wellness or peace or connection that covers my entire being and sits underneath everything that I do in the day. And I don't know when it happened, but it was there when I fell over. And it is, I think, these, I mean, in a way, it's obviously relevant to what Aurobindo is talking about, because it's the ball that's shifted to the fence inside my being in at least one of these areas, you know? And it's very interesting. You know, it's not, so anyway, I wanted to share that.
It was beautiful, Jeffrey. Thank you. And I think many, I mean, and this is not anything original, but a lot of traumas are actually create the conditions for a kind of permeability. And, you know, there's a, people are talking about near-death experience and stuff like that. We're definitely, the walls break down. Something becomes more permeable or transparent. And it's fascinating how when the trauma is over, we return back to the, you know, the confines of where we were before. But there's something a little more, I don't know, a little more curious, a little more open, a little more subtle about our experience, which is what I got from your poem, that after the accident and after you got a good report and you were released from that situation, there's still a sort of heightened sensitivity that may not have been there prior to this accident. And so thank you for sharing that.
I also, I don't know if it's related, but I had my first lucid dreaming experience because I've been trying your little practice, John, where I go to bed and I say, oh, well, I need to think about this. And it was just a fragment. It was at the tail end of a dream. And I noticed that I was dreaming.
Oh, wow.
Then I woke up. So it was very short, but it was the first time I can ever remember doing that. So. Maybe you know that's also a wall breaking and coming a fence in a different way, you know?
Oh, I think there must, I imagine there's a relationship, for sure, between that brief glimpse into that lucid dream and the lucid waking experience that you've had around this accident and being able to create a beautiful poem out of it.
So maybe Aurobindo is having his effect.
Let's blame it on Aurobindo.
Oh, the other thing I wanted to say about that first thing that I read, the first bit from the, can't remember how you, what you called it, Matthew.
Brihadaranyaka.
Yeah. it really struck me because we have in our world today so many people who are rejecting the other. I mean, we have these massive movements of people and everybody wants to put up their arms and say, you guys stay over here. I don't trust you. You know, there's us and there's them, and there's me and there's the other. And that paragraph, that short text, says that you can rethink things where the self is everything. And if the self is everything, there's no place left to put your arms up and say, don't come here, because it's all part of the same self. You know, although I suppose one can have, you know, and the next chapter deals with the fact that there are parts of the self that we don't understand very well. And so one can create a separation within the self between parts of oneself that one considers understood and parts that one doesn't understand. But, and those get projected outwards. But still, there is a kind of a rethinking about the role of the other and the self that I think is directly relevant and useful for the broader context.
There's something you said earlier too about Aurobindo and writing this in prison. And correct me if I'm wrong, Matteo, you would know, you're the scholar here, but I think he had those very profound experiences in the prison of these this exploration that he's, and then he wrote over many years this book, did he not? So this is a reflection actually of a process that got started in his prison experience. Did I get any of that right?
You got a few facts right. Before his prison experience, he went to see a yogi named Lele, and Lele taught him how to observe thoughts coming from the outside and completely silence his mind. This is before he was arrested for sedition. He was arrested for sedition, I think, he was in prison 1909 to 1910 for 11 or 13 months, somewhere in there. And in that time in prison, Swami Vivekananda, who had already passed away, came to him multiple times and kind of delivered to him what he called the Sapta Chatushtaya that Devashish writes about in his book, The Seven Quartets of Becoming. Very, very structured yoga, but he had already been opened and he was already having all these yogic experiences. And then in the Arya started publication August 15th, 1914. And that was due to the mother, Mira Alfasa, coming to Pondicherry and the collaboration of those two starting. And sort of an adesh, a word to start writing it for the global community. But all of this, I wouldn't call it even reflections. It's he's writing from experience. And I think that that's why the texture is different than most philosophy. But it was a philosophical journal. There's six volumes of the Arya actually republished in its original form. They're really beautiful. These books are impossible. They're not impossible to get. They're just not in print anymore. But they published six volumes of the entire Arya. And it starts off saying the Arya is a review of pure philosophy. The object which has been set before it is twofold. One, a systematic study of the highest problems of existence. Two, the formation of a vast synthesis of knowledge, harmonizing the diverse religious traditions of humanity, Occidental as well as Oriental. Its method will be that of a realism at once rational and transcendental, a realism consisting in the unification of intellectual and scientific disciplines with those of intuitive experience. This review will also serve as an organ for the various groups and societies founded on this inspiration. So, I mean, there you have it. It is a philosophical review, although it's just based on raw experience and intuition. Yeah, so it came, yeah, it's, It came out of that, but I wouldn't say it's like he spent a year in prison and had all these mental reflections and then wrote it down. It was, that's not quite it. Yeah. And another comment on something that you said a while ago, John, because the word sheath is so specific, I wouldn't say that it's metaphorical, because there's so much in the Upanishads, this languaging comes directly from Sanskrit. There's all the different, mind, life, and body. These all come from specific Sanskrit words. That's anamaya kosha, which is like, that translates literally as sheath filled with matter. And then pranamaya kosha, sheath filled with life, sheath filled with prana. Then manomaya kosha, sheath filled with mind. And then there's vijnanamaya kosha, sheath filled with psychic being, sheath filled with soul, individualized soul in the process of evolution. And then anandamaya kosha would be like the super bliss consciousness, sheath filled with super bliss consciousness or something. So I just, it's not a metaphor like the fence and the wall metaphor in that way.
Right, I understand. I think it comes out of Shankara, actually. That's where I remember the five sheaths and the pranic sheath and the material sheath. And I had always... And I also, you know, we're familiar with the chakras, which is wheel. And that's a metaphor that has its base in a metaphor, because it may have initiated as a metaphor, but then it becomes just a part of the way people frame things. And also the kundalini as a serpent. Those are all comes out of a cultural, I think, milieu. And I believe that it can be extremely helpful. But I think we need to sort of recognize that these great texts came out of people's experience, and they looked in their environment for something that they could use to communicate these very subtle experiences. And but I think when, as moderns, and I don't speak any Sanskrit, as I go back and study these texts, I sort of stumble over a lot of this stuff. But I realize as I get older that the experiences that I've had have a family resemblance that's so strong that I can read these texts and they can be illuminating to me. They don't have to be, so the metaphors they use can actually trigger my imagination in ways I think that across cultural sort of influences occur. So yes, but I appreciate your pointing that out, because I think there is a difference between a metaphor that's like a poetic device that someone's using and something that becomes a part of a tradition. I think he uses the actor poet metaphor also, I think in the next chapter, as an example of what the ego can be, I think, when it becomes a fence and it's more permeable rather than a wall that's entrenched. I think the act, he says it's the ego becomes, which lives and dies, the mortal self, but it's much more about it's much more like an actor playing different parts, or a poet expressing himself, herself, with the interplay of language and metaphor and story. So the ego allows for a kind of self-expression if I think this transition from a wall to a fence occurs. And that's really nice to know, because then we don't have to be spending the precious time we have here, these futile sort of trying to consolidate an ego that is never going to be consolidated. It's not supposed to be. but it doesn't have to be rejected. It can become a source of co-creation. We can allow things to occur that would not occur if we weren't in this participatory setup. So that's what I find so encouraging about this, is how participatory it all is, and how we all have can have a very creative role.
You know,
if we don't like that role, we can play another one, you know? You don't have to get fixed in it.
I heard a Catholic theologian somewhere making very similar thought experiments like this, so that only the one really survives, and, you know, there's just this one thing that basically goes beyond oneself. And, you know, like I read this chapter too with the actor and the poets.
Yeah,
it's what he points out is basically the you know, kind of this divine consciousness that's basically transcendental, and, you know, the rest is just comes and goes. I think it's in the twelfth chapter.
Yeah, I have 562. He says, the true being which we are no more dies by the cessation of one life than the actor ceases to exist when he has finished one of his parts, or the poet when he has poured out something of himself in one of his poems. Our mortal personality is only such a role or such a creative self-expression. So I'm very drawn to those theater metaphors. So I think there's a drama on stage. There's also an even bigger drama off stage. And I believe he sort of is playing with that metaphor. So we can all go backstage and we can watch how the drama gets set up. And that gives us a whole different way of, and when we go out on stage, if we're going to do that, we have a different relationship to the script and to our fellow performers and to the audience.
I'd like to reflect back on Jeffrey's poem. I had noticed a couple of things, but before I do, Frederick has joined us. He's in the waiting room. So if there are no objections, I'll let him in.
Please. Hi, Frederick.
Oh, hello.
Welcome. We've just been talking about these chapters, and I was about to reflect on a poem that Jeffrey shared with us a few minutes ago. You can see the recording later. It relates to his eye. One thing I'd notice is that the poem names perceptions that you have in the hospital room or in transit, or earlier in the call, I think John quoted a piece around these sheets where Aurobindo introduces a term he calls the circumconscient. So he doesn't talk a lot about the unconscious. He talks about the subconscient, superconscient, and he introduces this here. He doesn't really expand upon it, but the circumconscient. And it reminded me of the work you've been doing, Jeffrey, in field poetics, quantum field poetics, because I think that, I'll just read the sentence where he mentions this word, the subliminal, he's speaking about the subliminal self or consciousness, has, besides a formation of consciousness which projects itself beyond all sheaths and forms a circumconscient, an environing part of itself through which it receives the contacts of the world and can become aware of them and deal with them before they enter. So it seems to me part of what is happening in the poem is that that field awareness becomes present for you. And in this state of being, I guess, you were probably going somewhere. You probably had some things on your mind. You weren't necessarily in tune with or paying attention to the field around you, I'm guessing. And then this accident occurs, and this subliminal sense of what's happening around you becomes activated, or rather, you become aware of what you're already aware of. So I thought that was interesting that the field poetics in it came through in a very concrete way, not just because the street fell on you, but in the sense of the concrete perceptions that you had in the experience. And so just some reflections there on that. I think it's also interesting that he's writing this in the wake of, he doesn't talk about Freud or Jung or anybody else, but he's clearly presenting a different model that doesn't give that much importance to the unconscious, which, big dominant disruptive idea in this time. But he wants to say that what we think is unconscious is actually very conscious. We're not ourselves conscious. That is to say, the waking separative self is not conscious of what we're conscious of. So I think that's very interesting.
I think you're right about that. I think the ego is unconscious. And I think the ego projects its ignorance onto just about everything. But I think that's what Aurobindo is rejecting, because the unconscious is not unconscious to the unconscious. It's only unconscious to the ego, which is really kind of stupid and very myopic. So I think that he definitely rejects a lot of those, the ego psychology of Jung and Freud, coming out of that Kantian idea that you cannot know the thing itself, that you are restricted to just lots of different, you can construct all you want to, but you can't know the thing itself. And I think Aurobindo is not only saying you can know the thing itself, but you are the thing itself. It's a totally different world here.
I wanted to say, following what you said, Marco, that there is another hidden effect going on there too, which is the fact that I even wrote the poem in the first place, because I was sitting in that hospital room. I had, I had my iPad with me, but I had the eye all swollen up, and I wasn't that inclined to start opening up the iPad and doing stuff. I just needed to sort of vegetate out. But I was listening to everything that was going on and watching everything that was going on. And the impulse to write poetry is new to me. It's not something that I had it as a young man, but I lost it on the way. And it's only just beginning to come back. And it's partly the effort on quantum poetics that is bringing it back. So there's an attending to the field, not just in the tense, in the actual perceptions, but also in the act of writing about it in this particular way, which is also part of what's going on. Yeah. There are a couple of other things I wanted to say about, I'm not sure that I entirely agree with you, Johnny. My reading of the second chapter of the three was that there he does give a certain amount of place to the unconscious. Maybe not as much as Freud or Jung necessarily gives, but he does situate the unconscious as being a bigger thing than we tend to, we tend to think of, here's the conscious, and down here's, there's some sort of mysterious layer that we call the unconscious. But he's sort of saying, here's the conscious, the sort of ego, self-conscious part, and here's the unconscious, And then here are these other things going on, right? So it's a thing that says, you know, our sort of ego understanding of what's going on of the self is completely falsified by this self-importance of the ego, which doesn't correspond to what's going on. And that's something I have always felt to be true. Much more, you know, even beyond the sort of other underpinnings. I think in chapter 11, he also goes to talk on about I can't remember exactly how it works, but these different sections, and then he says, oh, but then there's also the supermind, and then there's the sub-sub-mind, and then, you know, we have these different pieces that I think he has five or six different elements that we need to think about.
Well, I think there's a difference between subconscious. When you're saying subconscious, something is under something else. And I think this is the subconscious was used by Freud quite a bit. And it was definitely under. And in his culture, it was extremely suppressed, but I believe he had a creative way of working with it, but a very limited way of working with it that I find absent in Aurobindo. I don't even think I think he's familiar with it. I think he's an extremely good psychologist and a phenomenologist as well. But I think there's a difference between something that's beneath and something that's next to something. So I feel like this is going from conscious up here, subconscious down there, to something that is both conscious and unconscious and kind of oscillating back and forth. But I think he's using different kinds of vocabulary for I believe, because I think he's trying to describe something very much more fluid and dynamic than something on top of something else. He does use ascending and descending language quite a bit, but I also feel like there's a lot of ambiguity. He talks about, he calls the ego the wall, which can become a fence, but he also calls it a bubble.
And he also says that the ego is necessary, which I also found very interesting, because you have a lot of people in the so-called sort of spiritual world who say, well, we need an egoless world. But he's saying, no, the ego, you need it. You can't get rid of it.
We need an egotisticless world. Egoism is very different than the ego.
I think you understand how to situate it, right? So,
I think we can be ego-free, but not ego-less.
No.
I think that's a disaster. But I also get it. I'm getting this image of much more of something that's unfolding. And for me, it's very fractalic. He didn't use fractal. But I think he must have been familiar with Einstein and that Riemannian geometry, that sort of new geometry that was sort of non-Euclidean geometry was starting to kick in, I think. Because I find I think he's trying for some sort of topology that's very friendly to me. And when we were doing some of those investigations into the Klein bottle and the Mobius strip and the torus, I feel like Aurobindo would be very comfortable with that. I may be wrong, you know, Matteo, you could correct me, but I feel like he's very visionary, and I believe he's using the metaphors of his time, but I think he was ahead of his time as well. And I feel like we're sort of the beneficiaries of this exploration, because I feel he feels very contemporary in these chapters, which I didn't feel that way in the opening of the first book, but I feel, but maybe it's not just getting used to his personality and the way he communicates, but I feel like there's a very sophisticated psychologist here. So thanks for helping me like sort this out.
A.S. Dalal compiled, made a beautiful compilation, thank you, of his psychology called The Greater Psychology. Ken Wilber wrote the preface to that book. It's a beautiful book. Yeah.
I think I have that somewhere. I'll have to look that one up.
What, Marco? I'm glad that you picked up on the circumconsciousness. He expands this in Essays on the Gita and in Synthesis of Yoga. But no, it's not, I don't think it's expanded anywhere in The Life Divine. And he also calls it a synonym for it is environmental consciousness. I think he called it that in Essays on the Gita and called it circumconscient in Synthesis of Yoga, but there may be like a half a chapter on it and more developed.
That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. One other point he makes, which I think is interesting and worth exploring perhaps, is that it's a critique of a conventional conception of consciousness, which is based on mental experience. And I think that this is related to the difference between the unconscious and not the subconscious. He calls it the subconscient. And, you know, he knew English very, very well. So
may I?
Please.
The difference between the conscient and the conscious is a Sanskrit word, loka, world. So the subconscient and the inconscient are the worlds. The subconscious is an individual's consciousness that's below the detection of being conscious. So you're and John was right too in what he was talking about. But that's the difference between the IENT and the OUS. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
World.
So,
okay.
It is kind of fractal then.
Uh-huh. Oh my goodness. It's so completely, it's like triangles all the,
and multiple worlds. Yeah. Many different worlds. Yeah,
and they're all layered on stuff. It's really like, and he recognizes it's impossible to do this with language. And that's why the mantra comes in and he talks about the mantric power and the essence of getting at the spirit behind the words rather than the ratiocination of words. He goes through this a lot. I mean, we have to have rational understanding, but there's a whole lot more depth to the words, and it's impossible ever to fill in reality with fragmented divisions like this.
Marco, you're right. I think these are the mental structure. He's very aware of how the mental structure projects itself, the mental projects itself on everything. And there's a quotation, I'm going to try to find it, but that supports exactly what you were saying.
Well, I'm in chapter 11, paragraph 6. I've taken Matteo to numbering my paragraphs. And I'll start in the middle. We are aware of a vitality working in this bodily form and structure, as in the plant or lower animal, a vital existence, which is also for the most part subconscious to us, for we only observe some of its movements and reactions. We are partly aware of its operations, but not by any means of all or most of them, and rather of those which are abnormal than those which are normal. Its wants impress themselves more forcibly upon us than its satisfactions, its diseases and disorders than its health and its regular rhythm. Its death is more poignant to us than its life is vivid. We know as much of it as we can consciously observe and use, or as much as forces itself upon us by pain and pleasure and other sensations, or as a cause of nervous or physical reaction and disturbance, but no more. Accordingly, we suppose that this vital physical part of us also is not conscious of its own operations, or has only a suppressed consciousness or no consciousness, like the plant or an inchoate consciousness, like the incipient animal. It becomes conscious only so far as it is enlightened by mind and observable by intelligence. And the next paragraph. This is an exaggeration and a confusion due to our identification of consciousness with mentality and mental awareness. Mind identifies itself to a certain extent with the movements proper to physical life and body and annexes them to its mentality so that all consciousness seems to us to be mental. But if we draw back, if we separate the mind as witness from these parts of us, we can discover that life and body, even the most physical parts of life, have a consciousness of their own, a consciousness proper to an obscure or vital and to a bodily being, even such an elemental awareness as primitive animal forms may have, but in us partly taken up by the mind and to that extent mentalized. So this is I think where the argument that he's making is that this subliminal, what we can access as far as intelligence or consciousness at the subliminal level is vast and is he's saying it's orderly in a certain way, I think, that it's not just a chaotic kind of, you know, clashing of forces or energies, but there's an intelligence there that for the most part we're not paying attention to because we're in our mental awareness. And I think the subliminal is interesting. As I was reading this, I read it early in the morning when it's very quiet, so there's not traffic, there are not a lot of other things going on around me. And I noticed that to the extent that my mind quiets and the reading kind of takes on a sort of shimmering flow to it, that I begin to notice everything going on around me, like the littlest sounds, the crickets chirping, the breeze rustling, very subtle perceptions that they're normal. There's nothing abnormal about them. I'm not like seeing aliens or anything like that. It's not, perhaps I would if I were to sit long enough, but that, what was occurring to me reading this is that that's always there and that there's some part of me that's always aware of it. And that is the really baffling thing, is that one can become aware of one's awareness, but one doesn't have to generate that awareness. It's already happening at that level, at the subliminal, because we become concentrated in our mental activities and goals and behaviors, we don't notice what we notice. And that's one of the things about poetry. This was Ginsberg, or maybe it was Ginsberg, one of the other beats, but the writing prompt was notice what you notice. And that's where the poem comes from. So I imagine that this poem that you wrote, Jeffrey, is you noticing what some part of you already notices, but you had to get knocked on the face for you to notice you're noticing, unfortunately.
I did just a quick check online. Although Freud had published his papers in 1899 and 1905, the Freudian school didn't really take hold until the 1920s. And the Jungian school came after that. So this book predates the emergence of those two psychological schools. I mean, the thinking was already in the literature to some extent. And perhaps he was aware of it, I don't know, but this was pre the Freudian school and pre the Jungian school in terms of the text.
You know, there are different editions of the book. He changed it, I think, 6 times or so. And there's, I have the 6th edition, and he added chapters to this book later on. So it's maybe not the one written in 1809, or I don't know when this was written.
My edition is 1940. This is a 1940. So I think Freud was well into his career, was almost over by then.
May I really quick clear this up? This book is 2 books of 28 chapters each. The original Arya was two books of 26 chapters each. So there were the original was published serially from 1914 to 1920-ish, somewhere in there, August 15th, 1914 to about 1920. when it was published in book form, it was World War II was just beginning. It was the late 1930s, and he heavily revised the first book, I think, in 1936, and it came out. And then book two that we're reading now was also heavily revised. Sometimes I get kind of nerdy and compare it to the original Arya publications and start marking out passages like I kind of did last week with Marco. I'm like, oh, this sentence was added. I have some of them marked out like that. It's really interesting to look at the different editions. But then other than that, once the first editions of the, like, once book one was published, first edition, and then book two was published, first edition, there were no other revisions made. So if I'm reading a first edition, which I actually have a hardbound first edition, it's exactly the same as this here that's like whatever, published in 2005, exactly the same. There's no, the archivist didn't go back and make any changes to this one. Not the same for Savitri, but that's another story.
Didn't he add the chapter on the triple transformation later on?
In 1940 or so.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was, yeah, and he's very well, he talked a lot about Freud. Freud is probably mentioned in the complete works of Sri Aurobindo at least 5 or 6 times. He's very aware of Freud's thinking and the schools that came out of that.
But also the notion of the unconscious predates Freud. And it plays a role in German idealism. It was important to the Romantics, and I'm sure he knew all about that.
I have perhaps a really trivial note about these books. I noticed that my book smells really good. That's very weird, but I stuck my nose in it. It smelled almost like incense or something like that.
Where's it come from? What edition is it?
It was printed in India. So
I hold it up. Yeah.
I have that one too.
I'm sure it sat in a warehouse that also manufactures and sells incense and things like that.
That's what I was thinking
that theme of what books smell like and how going back to a book that you might have read years or decades ago and smelling it evokes all of these extraordinary memories of just what it felt like to first read that book. So that, there's an essay in that, or maybe a poem or something that really needs to be written.
I think Doug posted something on the forum on Edgar Cayce. And I think it was it written by someone here? I think it was written by someone that we know. Wasn't it, Doug? But at any rate, he talks about Edgar Cayce and this a Croatian girl who evidently went into a coma. And when she came out of the coma, she was like a very fluid in German, which was a language she was trying to learn before she went into the coma. So she was a very crude speaker of German before the coma. After the coma, she was fluent. And she didn't want to speak Croatian. She only wanted to speak German. And Edgar Cayce, of course, he was a great psychic, but he tended to take naps all the time. And he had no memory at all. Evidently, he downloaded information in a sort of sleep trance state, which he was never aware of. People would record what he said. So it was he was very in a very dissociated state. But I think that article that Doug offered sort of adds, I think, to what Aurobindo is exploring, how the unconscious, what Freud was calling the unconscious and was slightly hostile to sometimes, I believe Aurobindo was recognizing as critical, because, you know, our egos, may be interested in a lot of things. It might prepare us for a lot of things, but we go to sleep at night and in our dreams or in our trance states or in our reveries or in our fantasies, a lot of this, a lot of work is being done. So I think this process So when we wake up and or we have those eureka moments, a lot of work is being done outside of our ego's awareness. But that doesn't mean it's just coming out of nowhere. Or that the work or the work we do in our waking state isn't influential, because I think all of that's being used. So I'm very curious about the relationship between the field that has been mentioned by Marco and by Jeffrey has been developing this, and poetry, and the superconscient. You know, how we may be updating Aurobindo as we participate in this reading. Because he feels to me very, very, what I'm thinking of is like Hubert Dreyfus, his model, his expert model, how we go from novice, actually we go from a beginner, we know nothing, we go to a novice, then we become efficient, then we become proficient, and then we become experts. And when we're an expert, we can make all the mistakes we want to and still be an expert. Actually, it's creative when experts make mistakes, but a beginner, it's not creative at all if a beginner makes mistakes because he doesn't know how it works. So I think that capacity to remember and forget, and then remember more, and then forget a little bit or partially, and then you become very adept and you become very skilled. You can forget a lot of stuff and experiment at the level of the expert. Yeah. And I think this is something going on with Aurobindo as well. As we evolve, we get more and more complex and more transparent to our own behavior. And we're less driven, I think, by those, you know, those beginning, being overwhelmed or disturbed by our ignorance. We can actually use all of that in a creative way as we become more masterful. So anyway, that's my two cents. Thanks.
If one is a bad actor, you're going to be stuck in your mind, memorizing your lines, saying, "Oh, I've got to get this right," or "I've worked on this all night," and you're going to be there behind that wall. There's no permeation. There's whatever is going on up there. And like you're saying, once you get a little bit better, you've had more experience, you're not so nervous once you're up on stage. You're able to begin step away from your mental book, like Marco was mentioning, going out and reading. And if you're a nerd and you're stuck in the book, you're going to see the words on the page. But if you're able to, you'll hear those sounds even while you're reading. And you'll take that in at the same time that you're dictating or reading your lines, and then the wall slowly becomes a fence. We slowly see the permeations all around us to the point where, like you're saying, you can forget that you're even an actor to a certain point, to where the lines don't matter, to where it just comes out in a flowing way. And even with that, and something I've been trying to, which I haven't worked on dreams all too much just yet, but I've watched videos, and I think it was Stephen LaBerge mentioned that, well, we focus, we have these peripheral things going on around us, but so if you're the actor, you're not going to notice the state, the audience at all. But once you remember, oh, there's an audience, then you might connect with one person and see their specific hairdo or eye color or whatever. And there's so much going on. And I think he was using this similar metaphor, kind of stating that in our dreams or dream state or even a waking state, we're not aware of all these various dynamics going on around us. And
so there was a quote that I had marked out from, I think it's in chapter 10, which describes the field. I made a note to myself that this is a wonderful description of field. So there is a constant mental, vital, subtle, physical interchange going on between all who meet or live together, of which they are themselves unaware, except insofar as its impacts and interpenetrations touch them as sensible results of speech and action and outer contact. It seems to me that's a very good description of the field effect in the sort of collective social sense that we've been talking about in our other conversations.
Well, I guess when I'm trying to make sense of this and translate it into things I'm more familiar with, I think in terms of actually back to Dreyfus, which goes obviously back to Heidegger and through Heidegger back to Aristotle, the distinction between knowing how and knowing that. And I'm still not quite clear on how Aurobindo is using the term mind. When I think of mind, I think of that thing that has propositional attitudes, beliefs and hopes and desires and fears and so on. And or, you know, anything that can be stated in the form of a proposition, X is Y. But of course, that doesn't capture what you were talking about, the idea of expertise, know-how, just knowing how to do something. And I think, you know, one point is just, you know, it's not that knowing that versus knowing how is, you know, inferior or superior or less, you know, less in touch with reality. It's just that there are two different ways of interacting with the world that are differently useful or differently important or that matter differently. Part of Dreyfus's point is that it's really important to think about your beliefs about things when something is going wrong, when something isn't working. Then you can take some distance from it and represent it to yourself and form some beliefs about it so that you can maybe figure out how to solve the problem. But there are other ways to solve problems. You know, experts don't solve all of their problems by representing the problem to themselves. Sometimes they just rely on their intuition or they mess around or, you know, what have you. So part of it is just knowing, I think, which context you're looking at. The mind is going to be, or maybe this is what the ego is too, I'm not sure. The mind is going to, ought to come to the fore, you know, in contexts where that's what's necessary. And it ought to recede when it's not necessary or appropriate. But of course, it doesn't do that. It wants to be there all the time. It wants to reduce everything to what can be put into propositional form. And, you know, reduced to a belief or a hope or a desire. I don't know if this is really getting at anything that you're finding in Aurobindo, but that's just sort of the way I translated it.
So, Frederick, don't you think that there's this tendency in Western thought in the 20th century to reduce everything to language? And don't you think that this is kind of, you know, obviously limited? I mean, there are people who talk about kind of a iconic gestures. So, like we can talk with pictures and with, you know, bodily movements. And
yeah.
There's, you know, just a lot more going on than just words all the time, you know?
Yeah, I agree completely, except that I think that not all language is sort of propositional in nature. I guess that's where I would...
I think that most things are not words, like in human interactions. It's words, but it's also, you know, just situations and body language and a lot going on that's not being said in words.
Oh, I agree completely. It's just that I would just say to reduce things to language doesn't quite capture the problem because, you know, Shakespeare is language, but that's also communicating things other than just claims about what is the case or what isn't the case, you know. You know what I mean? It's just poets and playwrights and artists and novelists can do things with language that aren't reductive. They're not just about making claims that, you know, some proposition is true or false and so on. But I agree with you.
Yes, but what about dance, for example, or just, you know, I think there are words and there's an existential dimension. And I think that Aurobindo very much gets to this with the Brahman. So the Brahman is everything. It is the whole world, which includes everything. And I don't think that the minds or, you know, whatever representations in terms of words and language, you know, they don't get to this. They're relative. And, you know, just the existence of the body and the bodily movement, you know, this is not captured, you know, this is not captured by words and language and, you know, things that are just there. Like, you know, a dancer or, you know, people just moving their bodies. You know, this is not, you can't get to this with words, you know. There's just something, you know, that it's just missing in, you know, in the world of thought, let's say, that doesn't capture this. And this kind of, I don't know, this for me at least, you know, this kind of, you know, I don't know, I feel it's kind of strange that people don't notice that there's something that's kind of lost.
Mm. It is strange. I agree that people don't notice it. It seems to be pretty obvious that words, in the sense in which I think you're using it, they're abstractions. You know, so clearly they don't get at the world and its particularity and its immediacy and so on. Although I think words put together by poets can do that.
Sometimes. I think you mentioned knowing how and knowing that, and Dreyfus's model, his expert model, came out of his rejection of AI. He's saying AI thinks that if you're an expert, you're going to be in trouble because AI is going to take over. And he says, if you're truly an expert at something, AI will never be able to affect that.
Yeah, because AI, he thinks, only uses propositional language.
Yeah, and there's expertise is not algorithmic.
Exactly.
But I think that you can use language in ways that are very novel and innovative and metaphorical. This is what and using, you know, simile and all that. And I think we talked a little bit about this, Frederick, on the forum.
Yeah.
And what you're saying, Tony, I agree, that the body and dance and music, and there's a great deal that's quite nonverbal. And that the verbal mind can use all of that experience and, you know, craft very novel language games. But I just wanted to quote Aurobindo because I think he's talking about this quite a bit in this one little section. I think he's talking about the transphysical. There's the physical senses, see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and then there's the transphysical senses. So I think this is the difference between knowing how and knowing that. And when an expert finds something is working, he or she can step back and create images and can shape shift and move them around in very novel ways, and then create models and language that reflects those kinds of experiments. But I think he says it really well here. He says, there is indeed an inner sense in the subliminal nature, a subtle sense of vision, hearing, touch, smell, and taste. But these are not confined to the creation of images of things belonging to the physical environment. They can present to the consciousness visual, auditory, tactual, and other images and vibrations of things beyond the restricted range of the physical senses or belonging to other planes or spheres of existence. This inner sense can create or present images, scenes, sounds that are symbolic rather than actual, or that represent possibilities, information, suggestions, thoughts, ideas, intentions of other beings, image forms, also of powers or potentialities in universal nature. There is nothing that it cannot image or visualize or turn into sensory formations. And he goes on to say, it is the subliminal in reality and not the outer mind that possesses the powers of telepathy, clairvoyance, second sight, and other supernormal faculties whose occurrence in the surface consciousness is due to openings or rifts in the wall erected by the outer personality's unseen labor of individualization and interposed between itself and the inner domain of our being. So I think he's playing with a physical senses and the transphysical senses. So we have at least 10. We have the basic physical five, and then we have those transphysical, at least see, hear, smell, taste, touch. But I think we also have affective ranges that are so much more intense than anything the outer ego mind can deal with. That's why the ego is very fragile and it can really blow a fuse, because sometimes these transphysical senses are so much more intense. And I think this is why poets and actors and writers and musicians hang out in these, attuning to these, affectively to these fields, because it's where they get their best ideas from. But I agree, I think we can use language, and language can emerge out of these direct experiences. But I do agree that there's much more going on than just the auditory digital part of our experience. If that were true, I think AI would take over. You know, it would leave, there would be nothing for us to do.
I don't want to get off topic too much in this AI business, but I do think that, I don't entirely agree with you, Johnny, that the AI is all about representation and propositions, because deep learning, the way it's done today, is a kind of reproduction of action, not just. It's more the how to than the what to. In that way, it's a very narrow kind of how to. But it's not just about it used to be with expert systems, just about propositions, but today's neural networks don't operate that way.
Right, I agree. And I think Huber Dreyfus was talking about first level AI.
Yeah.
And that's where his model was in contrast. But I think right now they're creating environments.
And the problem is they're too narrow.
Inside the head.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're looking for an environment that the robot or automaton or whatever can model.
I just don't think that would satisfy Dreyfus. You know, the second edition, the title of the first book on that was called What Computers Can't Do. And later he, updated it with a book called What Computers Still Can't Do. And part of his point is that to be an expert in anything, to act, to behave in the sense that we understand that requires a being for whom things are meaningful and for whom things are matter, for whom things matter. And there is no computer, there's no machine, as far as we know, for which things are going to matter or mean anything.
I agree entirely. I mean, I agree with that point, but I was sort of speaking against this idea that it's just about the prepositions. I think it's more about that. I think it's more that the computers really don't have a way of dealing with experience and meaning in the way that humans do.
I see.
That's the problem with AI, is they think it's going to replace that. Well, it's not,
Yeah, it's very strange. You hear these reports about computers that supposedly play chess, but no computer has ever played chess, right? I mean, I would imagine that to play chess, you have to have an understanding of what it means to be played, to play chess. And you have to, it's not enough to just spit out moves that can beat a real chess player. You have to care about chess and think that it means something and, have some, believe that something is at stake, whether you win or lose and so on. This is really off topic, so it's not, but it is remarkable to me how much traction this notion of artificial intelligence has got in the wider world.
Could it be considered another transphysical sense, potentially? Just not necessarily AI. Cyborg enhancement or something, but I love chess more than I ever have, just simply because there's so much out there with chess nowadays. But
oh yeah, I mean, consider it as a tool that, you know, conscious human beings use mm-hmm. their experience. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I'm talking about the claim that computers are actually learning or experiencing or doing things like playing chess. You know, I don't get that part.
And if it weren't for humans who had studied and played chess, would there be any computers who'd be taking up that as a hobby? I doubt it seriously.
Yeah. Maybe someday. Well, that's hard to say.
Well, to bring it back to
the
topic, I wonder if we could, or maybe if we're at a point in the conversation where we go back to the starting point. Jeffrey, you read one of the quotes from one of the Upanishads about self and not self. And it should be straightforward, but I think that what Aurobindo describes as knowledge by identity versus knowledge, separative knowledge, has everything to do with whether or not what one has knowledge of is regarded as self. And when we talk about language, propositional language or representational language, inherent in that mode of language is that there's a subject and an object, there's a self and a not self. So from the outset, it's a knowledge that is not by identity. It's a knowledge that presupposes separateness, and then can go about making propositions or representations. And you could use AI to make much more elaborate, you know, representations involving big data and, you know, dynamic, recursive algorithms that are improving the quality of the representations. But they're still representations of something that is regarded as not self. And what Fred and John, Jeffrey, I hear you saying is that there's no self in the computer. The self is the being to whom a representation would be meaningful. But language doesn't have to be used only representationally or only propositionally. It could be used not by the mind to divide, measure, process, effectuate some aspect of reality, but it could be used by the soul, or what Aurobindo and other traditions call the soul. Aurobindo also calls it the psychic being, because the psychic being can also communicate through the self and through the individual. And so it could use language differently than the ego uses language. And that would be just a function of choosing words differently, or of what is also communicated with the words, not just the propositional meaning, which a computer could parse, process, spit out, you know, some kind of result based on its scripts, but that one could transmit through language something of what it means to be a self. And that's what I think we'll see. I mean, that's what I think computers may never be able to do. Well, I don't want to be absolute about it, but could a computer transmit what it feels like to be alive through an AI-generated poem? I think it's going to get interesting when computers start doing that, because what are we going to be intuiting through those experiences? I think it's going to be very interesting, and maybe even the division between human computer will become more of a fence than a wall.
Well, but, you know Alan Turing and the Turing test. He said the Turing test only works if you presuppose that there's no such thing as telepathy. If there is telepathy, and if it can be proved, the Turing test makes no sense. I think there's plenty of evidence that telepathy is happening. This is a very good book. If there are any skeptics out here, Transcendent Mind by Julia Mossbridge and Immanence Barrus. They have some, it's a really good book. I'm reading it. But I think there's a whole lot of evidence that Turing may not have had access to. And I think all that stuff only works if you leave out a lot that we know. I think this is why we're under so much pressure, because I think the models that we're working with are so, as some of them are extremely sophisticated, and I love them, but I think that they leave out a lot of the anomalies that are perplex many of us. And I believe Aurobindo is paying elaborate attention on these anomalies.
Yeah, the Turing test itself gets a lot more respect than it really deserves. The fact that something could fool you into thinking that it's conscious doesn't mean that, it's easy to imagine that you might be tricked into thinking that something is conscious when it really isn't, because it's able to behave in a way that simulates consciousness. The notion that we have to ascribe consciousness or personhood to anything that appears to be a convincing representation of it, it's just not really a very powerful argument. It's a little puzzling why that test has sort of assumed the importance that it has. In other words, I might be, I might think, I might have every reason to believe based on the behavior of this other entity out there that it's conscious, but it still matters to me that it really is conscious. It would be a very different experience for me anyway. There'd be a very different value attached to relating to an entity that appeared to me to be conscious and relating to an entity that really was conscious. Those seem to me two pretty dramatically different kinds of propositions, really. And the Turing test is designed to efface all that.
That would be a philosophical zombie, right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It matters whether what you're talking to is a zombie or not. It might be an incredibly convincing zombie, and you might not be able to poke any holes in it at all. But it still matters to you whether it is or isn't, because it's obviously very different to talk to an automaton that is tricking you into thinking it's conscious and to talk to a real conscious entity.
Well, I've walked into a hotel lobby, and I've even walked along the street sometimes, and I'll look at a plant and I'll say, wow, that's so beautiful. I wonder if it's real. And I'll touch it, and I'll like, no. And I sometimes find out it's plastic. Sometimes it's not. But I think I think the Turing test is so artificial, because you're not touching that person.
Yeah.
And you're not smelling that person. And you're not really, I understand the Turing test is just working with verbal constructions, just sharing verbal constructs.
Yeah,
I see. This is a very pseudo intelligent test, I could call it.
Yeah.
Because I think we would know right away. Come over, honey, sit in my lap, give me a kiss. I think I know right away if this is a conscious being or not. But those the kind of things are just not there in the test.
Yeah.
I think the fact that he said if telepathy works, then the whole test makes no sense, because it presupposes a subject and object divide, which telepathy, of course, exposes as an illusion.
There are virtual, or no, not virtual, there are artificial intelligence programs that do phone calls. So they call you, and there are people who would take up the phone, and they don't recognize that it is an artificial intelligence. So in a sense, you could say that they passed the Turing test. They didn't know that this is just a robot voice that talks to them, and they do some kind of, they set up a meeting to a hairdresser or something like this, and the person calling doesn't know that it's a machine, it's called, So in a sense, they passed the Turing test. I can give you the link on YouTube. There are such machines already developed.
I know, I talk to them all the time. You know, I try to get a bill paid. You know, I haven't talked to a voice that belonged to an institution, a real voice, in decades. I mean, there used to be people who picked up the phone and said, hello, how are you? But that's been gone for decades.
There are a lot of real life human beings that don't pass the Turing test. Both ways.
They're human beings without enough sensory acuity to, to figure out most of what's going on around them.
But Turing was a mathematician. He wasn't an expert on consciousness or psychology or anything. And
she admitted, yeah.
And he was brilliant. And his real work is with the, I mean, in terms of a lasting contribution, is the Turing machine, not the Turing test. The Turing machine is the idea that you can take any proposition coming back to Frederick's turn and turn it into a very simple instruction set that you can run through. You know, so it's a formal understanding of propositions in terms of mathematics. That's brilliant work, but not the Turing test. It's not
right. I'm not trying to reduce Turing to the Turing.
I'm just saying that.
I'm just saying a lot of people have, though.
Yeah.
That's all they know about Turing is the Turing test.
Yeah. I need to transition to my next meeting. Thank you, everybody. I'll see you all next week.
Thank you, Matthew.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Good to see you.
Likewise.
So, but the Turing test it's really limited by the cognoscentric bias that Turing built into it. Like the notion that if a machine could produce language that was convincing enough, that, it would pass the test, and there'd be in effect no difference between a conscious or potentially conscious being. But we could imagine more extreme versions of the Turing test, and we could take it all the way to its furthest extreme. If it were to apply to robots who in some future technology are nano engineered to look, feel, taste, sound like the real thing, could we tell the difference? And then at that point, I think Frederick's point still matters. It does still matter to us whether or not the other being is actually a self, is actually conscious. But we could take it to an even further step beyond that, which is to begin questioning whether anybody that we engage with is real or not real. I could, in a paranoid fantasy, like a Philip K. Dick novel or something, begin to question whether or not this whole reality that I'm experiencing and all the people that I interact with, all of you, are maybe not some elaborate ruse, some trickster's play, or maybe like my own, to entertain, to deceive, what have you. But I mean, we could take it to that extreme, and then what kind of, the question I think becomes, in a world of radical epistemological uncertainty, when you can't know whether the apparent self you're interacting with is a real self, what kind of ethics comes out of that?
Well, I think we should hesitate before we accept the proposition that we live in a world of radical epistemological uncertainty. I mean, I think, you've described the skeptical problem beautifully, and it is a problem, obviously. And on the other hand, it applies to everything. I mean, maybe this is it doesn't apply just to the question of whether there are other minds. It applies to absolutely everything. And so in that sense, not being able to be certain about other minds, a person who can't be absolutely certain of that is in no worse a position than anybody else with respect to any other problem, right? Because the idea is that we could be radically, dramatically wrong about everything we believe. And, that's just such a fundamental, But to go back to your question, yeah, so what sort of ethics comes from this world of radical epistemological uncertainty? So you probably posed that question because you have an answer to it.
Well, I don't know if we should jump to that, Max. I mean, I don't know if that radical epistemological, I mean, there's a something there that has, that is informed by where we draw the boundary between self and non-self.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think that's a relevant question, but I think there's another relevant question, which is, I mean, in a sense, the people who are doing AI, I'm not saying they're right. I mean, we agree that they are wrong in terms of what they think is going to work. But it's still, the idea underneath it is that human beings are physical. They are a physical construction. And therefore, one should, in principle, be able to construct an individual in such a way that they would have the same properties as a human being. Now, you know, the robots and the things that they're producing now probably aren't going to cut it. But that doesn't mean to see that the problem is impossible. And then the question is it possible? And if it's not possible, then why is it not possible? Is it because there's some undefined entity that one might call a soul, you know, that you have to have in order to get the self? And if you can't construct, you know, so it comes back to, this is where the context of Aurobindo still matters, because it's not just perhaps about constructing something. It's perhaps something more that needs to be there in order for it to work.
And there's more going on in Aurobindo's world than just causes and effects in a physical world. He's talking about the ways and means of the subtle realms, which are much more complex. And I believe that's where he's, the self and the other and the subject-object divide and that wall that becomes a fence. I think in these subtle realms, those become big questions, because you're dealing with the other entities. And what is their status? Are they just projections? Are they thought forms, something that I've created? Or do they have, or is there something else going on? And I think those are, you can end up in a really solipsistic nightmare. And I think he warns against that. I think he says there's a zone you can go into and you can get stuck there in these subtle realms. It's, I would say, the hell realms. But I have found myself in these subtle realms. I remember asking, all thought forms vanish. And they all, everything emptied out in this room except for, there were four figures and they're all behind me. And in my subtle body, I still have a front and a back. So I turned around and I saw these four figures. And I assumed that they were not thought forms. And there was a different kind of relationship, perhaps an I-thou relationship, that could be established. But I'm guessing, I'm interpreting. And this is all operating, it's a semiotic system. And there are all kinds of signs that I have to figure out. But I think in the waking world, we can actually, I assume, it's an as if construct I use, that you are all real and that you are all divine. It's just a good thing to do. I get along much better. And I've noticed this is a practice. I walk down the street. I don't use Brahman. I use Christ. And I live in Manhattan. I'm surrounded by crazy, insane people yelling in their smartphones. And I just say to myself internally as I walk down the street, each stranger, Christ, 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 Christ. And in about 5 minutes, I'm high as a kite. People start glowing. I feel ecstatic. And I have to stop doing this practice, because I have to restrain myself from going up to strangers and hugging them. So it's an imaginative act, but I think it has very real psychological benefits if we act as if other people are as yourself, divine beings. And that's a great corrective to those very constrained, egoic, traumatized states that one can get into, where you're surrounded in this kind of paranoid interplay with other people. So I think it can have a very lived, very real and vast lived significance.
I was going to note that for me, when thinking about the questions that have been posed, that I can deal with the illusory world. I can say, okay, well, I've already worked with that. Is this a dream? Is this this? Am I still sane? Something like that. But if we were to take AI into the mind, it could be a body in front of me, that's great, but it would just be another form. But if it took over my mind in some sense, then if I had instability, then there would be no ethics, there would be no chance at developing a self, I think. And that would cause insanity. That we've all experienced some sort of insanity, whether it's driving down the road and something bad happens, or walking down the road and something bad happens. And we have those thoughts, but then we are able to take that away and go back to our stability. But that would be my personal nightmare is, well, if the AI, if they put nanobots in my mind and that said, well, here's a thought, buy this book, or even beyond advertisement, and just went into daily thinking, and I wouldn't be able to know if it was my mind. So either I'd go insane or I just wouldn't know, and I would be controlled by some outside factor. And I wouldn't be able to get to that illusory world, to get past that illusory world, because it would always be there no matter what, based on the mind control. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. I have...
Arguably, it's already happening. I mean, mm-hmm. How many times do people feel like they're being followed around by advertisements online, for example? But how many times do they not notice that they've been followed around by advertisements online?
But even that, for me, at least for me personally, I feel like that's the Turing, the simple form of the Turing test. Like, oh, I see what happened there. I did the search, and oh, now there's all these little things popping up on YouTube or something like that, and buy this toothpaste or something. But yeah, if it goes beyond that point where then I would be inclined to say, sorry guys, these have been some great conversations, but I think I'm not going on the computer for a while, and I'll stay with my stable world and my stable mind. But anyways, that's all I want to say about that. I think, want to get too dark.
I think it's one of the dystopian features of our world right now is mm-hmm. that most people are not unplugging and resting or in their subliminal self. So if you're not in your subliminal self, where you would be aware of the influences that are being exerted on you, because there's this kind of AI, this automation, this mass automation, all these big technology companies, in effect, are the AI. Like, they're the engines. That this is what they're about. But it's really automation. I mean, at bottom, the Turing, the complete, like, if I understand the computer science, it means that you can have a script, a set of instructions that terminate. So a Turing complete machine is simply one in which one step could lead to the next, and then terminate at some kind of conclusion. But humans are the ones who own those machines and who are, put them to use for their own ends. So all the technology companies are essentially running these scripts that are self-optimizing for making a lot of money. And billions of people, the majority of humanity is plugged into that and has their cognition, their attention, their emotional lives, their social lives, their political existences processed through that script. I think that, you know, when I think it's a big and a very important question to look at that critically and to look at like what are the machines that we're setting up in our environment and what are the intentions that those machines are serving, whose intentions, toward what ends. And if they're not our ends, if they're not ends that we would agree to, that we would want, that we would envision, desire, then we have to change. We have to revolt, basically, and reconstitute our environment. That's a big.
But Aurobindo says in that quotation earlier, he says you can deal with them before they enter. You don't have to let them in. You're just giving away your power. That's all. And there are all kinds of techniques for dealing with intrusion. In shamanic traditions, there's tons of techniques to prevent intrusion. I think they're going to be probably new kinds of paranormal experiences because of our interaction with the internet. And I think Banerjee has written about this too, that if you use it enough, you're going to contact the shadow of the technology. But I think we gave away too much power and think we have these robots who are going to take over. This is our fantasy. You know, we can make it come true if enough of us give away our power to. But we're much vaster than this stuff, this artificial intelligence stuff. But I do think we do need to take care of our own psychic hygiene, though. We have to be very vigilant, I believe, in keeping out the intrusive stuff, because the vital body is very drawn and attracted, as Aurobindo says, to these kinds of negative displays.
And, you know, I have a theory that we are like maybe 95% on running on scripts all the time. We are totally unconscious all the time. And, you know, 95% of our daily routines are already set in place. We are going through the move every day. And I think there may be like 1-3% that you can move around a little bit. And the rest is just on autopilot. And through something like, you know, an integral yoga or meditation or something like this, you can get a little bit more choice, a little bit more awareness. So it's maybe not 3%, but maybe 5% that you can move things a little bit around to get a little bit more awareness of your, you know, inner life. And that way you maybe do have a little bit more choice. So I think, you know, I don't believe that we have no free will. And I think we have a little bit free will, like 5-3% or so, and you can get more through meditation and, you know, yoga or whatever. And but the rest of our own, you know, self system is actually almost like a machine, you know. But the difference between, I mean, ourselves and, you know, the real machines is that we have like 2 billion years of biological evolution running through us, and we are like, you know, some people would bring up this metaphor of hollows, right? So we are like parts and holes stacked on top of each other, like if in 2 billion years, and it's a very different type of process that happened with the human body, you know, and there's just this awareness stacked on top of each other, and this purusha or consciousness like watching out of it, and you don't get this with machines. So there will be like something that of a different category, and whatever their consciousness is, it's just like, you know, something of a, you know, totally alien nature. You know, hasn't been there before, probably.
Nicely said. I was thinking earlier that maybe it's time to go back and view Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Since that's yes. where we seem to be stuck.
It's always time to view Fritz Lang.
You know, Edward, in what was it like? Like how do you call this dreaming? Conscious dreaming? How do you call it?
Lucid dreaming.
There's a technique that you can do while lucid dreaming. I only done it once. So if you're dreaming and you know that you're dreaming, you can just spin around in a circle. You spin around in a circle. So you move in a circle, and that way you don't wake up.
That's right. You're stabilizing your vestibular system, your inner ear.
I don't know how that works, but you don't wake up and you know that you're dreaming.
Yeah, it works. I've used it quite a bit. You can stay in a lucid state for a very long time. And that's a very good technique.
I'm going to go, guys. My eye is hurting, so...
Yeah.
Feel better.
Mm. Good night, Jeffrey.
Good night.
Good night.
Yeah, I'm gonna head out too.
I have yes. to go too, but before I do, could I ask a question of those who are still here? Speaking of holism, does anybody here know of a book by Jan Christian Smuts called Holism and Evolution? Mean anything to anybody?
I saw a movie about him once, maybe a documentary, but I never read that book.
Okay.
I'm familiar with him. Yeah.
I haven't read it either yet, but I came across him because I was in South Africa for a couple of weeks and just looking into South African history, and he seems to have been an extraordinary kind of Renaissance man. He seemed to be good at everything, knowing how and knowing that. And he has what looks like a really tremendously interesting attempt to, I really shouldn't try to say what it's about yet, but it seems to be about drawing some conclusions about evolutionary theory for sort of metaphysics and a metaphysics of holism and kind of ecological, not just ecology in the biological order for this physical sense, but mind as ecology. It seems very Batesonian. So anyway, I was just curious if anyone heard of it. But, I'll read it. Let you know what it's like next week if you're interested.
Write a review for us.
Yeah, right. No, I won't do that, but I'll blab on about it if necessary.
Actually, I think it was a movie about him that I seem to recall.
Interesting. I will look into that.
I'll look it up.
One of the things that we've kind of been doing has been, you know, if one person has a particular interest in an author or book, they could bring it to the rest of the group and maybe bring an excerpt or, you know, some way that others can connect with it so that we get the benefit of your deeper dive you know, without all having necessarily to read the book, or we may, like, it may become that it's so relevant to, you know, other conversations that it's worth addressing or including, like, so yeah, on that note, I've been in touch with TJ, and TJ has participated in some of our other reading groups. He's read Peter Sloterdijk's work with us, and
he did some Aurobindo work too.
Aurobindo as well. And I thought that perhaps what we could do, one thing we could do is
how is he, by the way?
Summer has gone unexpected. It sounds like things did not go as planned with his reading. And
he was going to do this program.
Right. So he hasn't kept up with the reading or anything. But I asked him if he would be open to maybe doing a session on the human cycle, which he read and wrote a number of posts about. And there was a lengthy interaction on it. And it would be a way where we could read a bit of it. It's all online. All this material, the PDFs are there. And have a discussion that takes a little detour and then comes back to complete this text through the fall.
So. He also wrote a good essay on playing chess. which is a family activity. It's a very touching sort of tribute to that game, since we've been talking about chess.
Yeah.
And some, it's in the Cosmos Journal.
Yeah, it's on metapsychosis.com. It's called At Play. And it's cool because there is, it's a personal story, but it's a philosophical story, and it also reflects a bit on the AI question. And, so anyhow, just bringing that up because it's, I think, the kind of thing that we could do. And
that would be fun. I would love to.
And we're nearing the end of the first part of book two. And so, you know, we're going to be on the, you know, the final leg of this starting in September. So it could be an opportunity to refresh maybe our approach, you know, to just take a breath, rethink it. One thing I think would be useful would be if, this is just an idea that occurred to me today, so you know, take it or leave it, but if we had individuals who, in a sense, like steward individual chapters, where, you know, with all these chapters remaining, one person kind of picks up that chapter and maybe starts a discussion about that on the forum, or gives a summary of the chapter when we discuss it in these calls. So just some way to, I don't know, bring a little bit more structure to what we're doing, and also make sure that we really make the most of this opportunity, because I'm sure I'll read this again, but I'm not going to read it probably in this particular format in this particular way again. So, you know, I want to make the most of it.
One other suggestion. Doug mentioned this, Irreducible Mind, and the chapter on memory. You know, and if we're coming up with topics in the cafe, if we're struggling for topics, we always have this book, Marco. And a chapter is easily read in a week. So I'm just thinking about those Tuesday cafes.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's plenty of stuff on the paranormal in this book. That's what the book is really about. And I think it really, they talk a lot about the subliminal self in that book. Mm-hmm. And many different models. I just think it would really complement the Aurobindo discussions. So that's just a possibility for the cafes in the future.
Yeah, and Fred, we get together every Tuesday at noon Mountain Time and have different topics every week, most weeks. Open to suggestions. Yeah, and that would be a perfect venue for something like Holism and Evolution a chapter from it or something.
Oh, okay. Did you say every Tuesday or Wednesday?
Tuesday.
Yeah. Tuesday.
Tuesday at noon Mountain Time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we do a reading or a movie or something like that. Mm-hmm. Talk about.
Great, I'll look into that. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, very nice. Thank you.
Welcome back, Frederick. Nice to see you.
It's good to be back, although I had a great time being away, I must say. Not from here, but being where I was. So.
It's great.
All right, bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.